Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 302. How can you improve your LLM agent systems through specification enrichment? What are the advantages of having an LLM act as a judge within an agent system? This week on the show, senior IEEE member and quality engineer Sunit Malhotra joins us to discuss building and evaluating agentic architecture. Sunit is an independent practitioner researcher with 18 years of experience in quality engineering and test automation for consumer scale platforms. He discusses building specification enrichment loops, monitoring performance, and using Cohen's Kappa to measure agreement between LLM judgments. Sunit is currently publishing multiple papers that are under peer review on these topics. He also provides links to his work and GitHub projects if you want to experiment with these concepts and methods yourself. Quick heads up, if you got a couple moments, check out a quick survey we have about our show notes page. In fact, it's the first link you can find below the description of this episode. And thanks in advance for providing your feedback. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Sunit. Nice to meet you.
Hello. Hey, Chris.
It's cool to have you come on the show and talk a little bit about AI. We've been diving into AI agents quite a bit over the last several months. And you had listened to one of the other previous episodes and said, hey, I got some ideas. I said, okay, this sounds really cool. Like, I haven't heard a lot of these terms. What I wanted to start with, your current role has you as a test engineering leader. And I feel that that's an interesting part of the industry. Mm-hmm. We talk about testing off and on here at Real Python, but I feel it's maybe not one of these things that a lot of people set out forth when they start their career in programming. I know there's a lot of people that find it super interesting. And so I kind of wondered, like, well, how did you get into test engineering? Mm-hmm. You don't have to go all the way back to like when you were just, you know, starting programming or whatever.
Yeah.
What's the abbreviated path that you had to getting into testing?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been in the industry for around 2 decades, 20 plus years. So I did a master's in computer science from USC. Typical path was like, hey, just become a programmer, find a job as a developer, and kind of start your career.
Yeah.
But what happened was I ended up getting an internship during my school up north, up in the Bay Area, as a part of my intern program, which was more of a QA automation engineering specific.
Okay.
Where that was like my first foray into the real world, working in a company where I got to understand how the process works, the life cycle of a product delivery. And in my QA automation role, I ended up like coordinating closely, working closely with product, dev developers, database team. So it was kind of, I got to understand like how as a test engineer, automation engineer, I still got to do the coding for automation and all the stuff I was doing. But I also was more involved throughout the life cycle of a product delivery. Whereas a developer, you are just zoned in into just coding and then getting the feature out.
Yeah.
So that really got me, first of all, excited about this role. And what happened was I kept getting more internships and full-time jobs based on my kind of my already experience I had in the couple of internships I did.
Yeah.
So I ended up just like getting more opportunities in the same role. And then it kind of randomly got into the career of test engineer and really started liking it in the like a first couple of years. And that's how kind of I got into this and really got to know like the whole end-to-end process, life cycle, SDLC. And I got to do that as well along with coding. So kind of, I felt like it was a happy path of both. And yeah, so been in the industry for around 2 decades, really, really good journey. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like maybe in some ways that was a unique feature of your resume that helped maybe open some doors for you.
Exactly. Because typical resume would be a developer or coder, graduate from a computer science degree.
Yeah.
So that was kind of gave me like a unique sort of a resume and unique background where I got to get the opportunities which other folks didn't. So
yeah. You have a lot of background in these very large public facing product type of things. You worked for Amazon for a little while, for Live Nation, Tinder. You worked for a variety of different of these very large, if you think about end-to-end software products, the SDLC, as you call it, the software development lifecycle. Has that changed like your focus at all on testing, or has it just sort of increased like your ability to kind of see the whole picture? Because I feel like that's part of what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. I mean, I started in the media companies like Oprah Winfrey Network, Ticketmaster. So all these like bigger sort of companies have like quality is the focus because they are customer obsessed. They want to make sure the products they're launching for the users, customers are really very high in quality. That's why you will see like there's a lot of opportunities in these sort of bigger companies, bigger customer facing products. We're especially working at Amazon for 8 years. Customer obsession is one of the key sort of principles Jeff Bezos had. LPs were just working backwards from the customer and then figure out like how do we make sure our customers get the best experience in terms of new features, moving fast, shipping every week, so that customers like incrementally get new and new additions, like a new features every week. So they're delighted by small features that we ship at Ring or some other companies. So that's where my background came in as I eventually became a leader of bigger organization, like just managing different time zones, getting automation, getting all the coordinating among different teams. So really, really got excited about these opportunities I had, and currently at Motorola, again leading a bigger team where I'm really launching a new products, new features for real users. So that gets me really excited every day, getting up and get to something like which get delivered to millions of users at the same time.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting is that you're also kind of making a little bit of a turn in, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, in getting involved with publishing papers on some of these concepts that you have. And that's partly what you wanted to come to talk about, working a little bit more with the IEEE, I would guess. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, coming up with writing papers and doing things like that?
Yeah. So pretty much like end of 2022, where this major shift happened with the ChatGPT launched, where, hey, you could talk to a chatbot and it will reply you with a bunch of text and related to your questions, right?
Yeah.
But what I noticed in the last year, I would say 2025, where all this shift from chatbot to agentic engineering, basically where you give the AI agency to do things on your behalf, that's where I felt like it had a major exponential shift, where you're just not just getting answers from a chatbot, but you are actually having multiple agents who will do the task on your behalf. So really got into it end of last year, where I started just shipping like my own website, more features, just trying out different products. And that's where I got into like, hey, there is an opportunity. Like I have this lot of experience in test engineering, and I see with all the agentic pipelines, there is an opportunity for me to, as I try to find different ways to improve this whole life cycle.
Yeah.
And there's an opportunity for me to contribute to the open source community. So I started providing the code open source for anyone to take a look at it. And that's how I got into different sort of organizations. So I'm a IEEE member as well, and started contributing to these communities where I feel like learning, writing white papers, learning from the folks who are in the similar field, and will really help shape the next few years in this industry. So that's how kind of I got into it.
Yeah. It's kind of cool because you're able to take a lot of the knowledge that you've been developing over this time prior to LLMs being a big thing and agents becoming a part of the program, and saying, hey, there's a lot of knowledge that was still here that I could help apply to this new paradigm. And so we want to talk about that a little bit, how that knowledge applies, how you can improve upon what these sort of systems you're setting up, some concepts of judging and grading the quality of what's happening. And so, yeah, I'm excited to kind of dig in. You suggested this title for the episode of Building, Grading, and Writing Up AI Agents That Actually Ship, which I think is a good title. I think the part that might be a little different are the two other verbs there of grading and writing up AI agents. So maybe let's talk about the writing up part first, because I feel like that might be our way in.
Yeah, definitely. So like I said, okay, now you have agents, you can start an agent to write a code for you. If I'm a developer, right? So just write an agent, give it the context about my GitHub repo, about my feature, what I'm trying to write, right?
Yeah.
Give it a context and it will generate a good code for me. How do we make sure just generating from AI slop to really have a production grade ready? And that's just not limited to developer, but automation engineer, a QA engineer writing test cases, starting from the initial product delivery for a product manager who is looking at the design, right, writing requirements. So basically what I try to capture is whole life cycle of a product delivery from writing requirements to developer writing code to then writing automation test cases and then delivering the feature to the production. So kind of how you use different agents and then how you connect all these through with MCP. So MCP is nothing but it's like you can say it is a USB-C where it just acts as a, it's like an API where you use that a protocol to give AI agency to talk to your applications.
Yes.
So let's say in this case, for a product manager, he has access to Confluence where they typically any companies like write all the requirements, all the repositories about the feature they ship, right? So that,
okay,
and the product manager can use Claude Code or Codex or what have you, whatever AI they are using. So with MCP, they connect to that Confluence where it will talk to your, it will get the access to your Confluence or Jira. But it will get all the knowledge base. Like you don't have to manually provide all the PDF or a Word document or context. You just provide the link and your AI will talk to that tool in case of Figma or Confluence and get all the knowledge base you need. Just provide it the direction about the URL and then it will take all that sort of a knowledge base and help like write the requirements for you. So it gets you like 80% there with respect to the quality. And I think it's more about the context that you provide to it as well. So how much like background about the feature or what have you.
Yeah. So we've talked about MCP on the show quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an interesting development, you know, since, like you said, 2025. I agree that the description of the pluggability, the USB of it, but also it being an API, this idea of like being able to send and receive information. And what I found most interesting in my metaphor that I keep using is this idea that this agent can then request information from this service and say, well, how do I speak to you? And it then gets that information back through this protocol, which is really kind of cool. I jokingly say it's like the Matrix, you know, like, oh, I now know Kung Fu or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick to it is, and I think people are getting better as they've done this, because a lot of people just like, we'll just convert our entire API into MCP. And it's like, no. It's like you're exposing too much of it. You need to kind of think of it more around tasks. Do you agree with that idea? Like MCP should be narrowly focused like toward like what you want this thing to be able to pull out of it and leave some of the other types of stuff that, you know, still would be good for an API.
Yeah, definitely. And like right now, I know the context is increasing. But right now, I think AIs have like 1 million lines of context they have, right? So you just want to make sure you provide the right sort of background context, which really help to have AI understanding about the feature that you are trying to deliver. If you provide too much data into it, it will just create a slop for you.
Right.
Because you just want to make sure you provide more sort of a clear sort of a goal that you have. And then make sure you provide the clear context in terms of what background about the context feature. Only then you will get like to 80-90% of accuracy. So that's how you kind of then learn, work with AI, provide it clear goals, and then it recursively kind of improves upon that as well. So as you keep building that sort of a knowledge base with the help of MCPs, just make sure you just don't provide just everything that you have in your company. Otherwise, it will just provide generic AI slop, which is very hard to then you have to manually go and fix it.
The context sort of collapses in a way because it's just got too much information in it and can kind of be overridden in that way, which I've heard some strategies, and that's probably a different show, mm-hmm. is to talk a little more about like, well, how do you manage that? But one of the ways is just to like, okay, keep it narrow if you can, and you just provide the information you need. One of the things that you had in kind of an outline that we were looking at was the problem. And I think that maybe this goes into a little bit about even writing or publishing an article about this stuff is that so much of the coverage of AI and LLM and agentic stuff is very, very hype driven and very, very flashy without any true, like, you know, what are we actually trying to ship here, and getting down to maybe something that's a little more boring of like, well, let's get down to actually like what truly is happening behind the scenes. And so you kind of talked about this a little bit, this idea of like a theater versus methodology.
Yeah, definitely. So we just want to make sure, right? You just use the fancy keyword like, okay, AI, we got to this 10x improvement, or just token maxing and all this term right. that you keep hearing in the companies, right? But what we want to see is like, how does it actually benefit engineer? And that's where I think this getting into this end-to-end life cycle of a process where you act as your, let's say, junior intern or someone who is helping you out. So let's say if I'm a product manager in a company where I'm managing 5-6 projects, I don't have enough time to write clear requirements or write all the Jira stories for our developers. What it does, it helps me to be 3x or 4x more productive, right? Instead of manually, like what you would do previously, pre-AI ages, you start manually typing it, writing all the requirements from what you understand, writing Figma diagrams, architecture diagrams, which would take you days just to get a requirement document at level which can be reviewed by the leadership, right? But what AI does, it get you right away. If you just have enough context, enough idea, you can talk to a chatbot, get some ideas, first of all, with AI, like what you're trying to launch in a company or a feature on your startup. And it gives you like a 3x or 4x more productive, where you can spend that time, instead of writing requirements, more about shipping new features or working with your teammates to deliver it. So that gives you methodology where you're just not focused on one or two features, but it gives you more agency to deliver like multiple things at a time. Just gives you like more productive. So that's why kind of sure. It takes away from all the AI hype or token maxing to just be your sort of intern where you get a 3 or 4 interns with you, right? So you get to do more with the help of that AI. So that's how I kind of feel the methodology where you are improving your productivity.
One thing that you're pointing out there, which I'd like to dig into just briefly, is just this idea of using a chatbot, like you said, to come up with the initial information. Like you said, before you were putting all this information into Jira and coming up with like a written plan and then presenting it to management, you know, and then maybe that's handing it off and explaining it yet again to a junior engineer to start working on this task. Mm-hmm. You're saying maybe we're pulling back a little bit and having a conversation back and forth with, help me develop these strategies and help me write up these specifications. Is that kind of what the process is like?
Yeah, definitely. And kind of what I call this term is specific enrichment, where I just did some open source work as well on this in my GitHub repo. Basically, what problem I kind of noticed was most like AI augmented like pipelines fail in two ways, right? So one is like model just generates a wrong test for the design that it was given, where the other one, which is more like less steady, is like model like generates correct test, but the design is incomplete or incorrect. So example,
okay.
So let's say if you are working on a basic example, I can go for a user like a visitor app where someone comes in, visit a corporate or office, right? They sign in as a visitor, prints a badge, host get notifies, and then they come to pick you up or get you into the office, right? It's a very simple app.
Okay.
And if you use AI, it will create a bunch of tests like, okay, make sure all the positive cases where you are able to successfully come in and get the badge access and get in, right? But what it fails is like that implicit constraints like that design, which assumes but does not state. So like what happens if a badge printer is offline?
Sure.
Or what happens if the host email bounces? Or what happens if there is issue with badge IDs, like just not persisting across different sessions, right? So what if the visiting hours or windows are limited? So how do you make sure the AI might not have a context? Like, let's say if it's a new application you're building, right? You give AI a basic of a prototype of the app. Unless you provide these sort of constraints or figure out a way, what I call this a specific enrichment, AI will miss all these edge cases, and what we'll get is 60% or 50% product eventually, right? Which is missing all the scenarios.
Sure.
So my kind of study has been like, how do you kind of incorporate all these sort of constraints before even getting the requirement out to when you're shipping abroad, building a product to users? Put that process in the initial sort of a pipeline before even you are writing the code.
Right.
So understand those constraints and then put that into the pipeline.
Yeah, because what they've built is a prototype and not something that lives in an environment and an actual organization and deals with, you know, like you said, other systems like, okay, the printer, and you know, the printer doesn't have whatever the materials it needs, or it's offline or some other kind of networking issue, and it wouldn't know to test for that. Are you, during that specification enrichment situation, are you using historical examples or other types of information to do the enrichment? Like what does that look like as far as trying to tease out that additional information?
Yeah, definitely. So what I did was, it's different from RAG, like retrieval augmentation. It kind of just provides like more of a supplementary context from the same design artifacts, so which the pipeline already has. So let's say if it's a login application for any big feature, right?
Okay.
So what I did was train my model on some basics, sort of, first of all, I understand the design, and then it has certain threshold where it will run these tests again, edge cases, and will provide a score for you in the end where, let's say, if you meet a certain threshold of, let's say, 0.7 out of 1, only then it will push the changes to downstream pipelines from requirements writing to other designing and other test cases as well. So basically what I will do is I will look at the design and kind of then what constraints like that design has, right? So score each design from 0 to 1. And then use that, like you look at the initial sort of artifact and give it a score. And based on that, you start to then working with AI and start to see like what cases that that feature might have missed, and continue to feed that more sort of a learning loop from the same design until with the help of AI. So basically, you, instead of someone asking the questions to AI, you are kind of working the back and forth in loop until you get a certain threshold of a score. So that if score is met, then you are ready to move to the next step. So basically, you are just building a sort of a test pipeline where you block that pipeline to move further until you move that specific enrichment threshold criteria that I've built in into my system. And I used a couple of open applications where I tried that with this sort of a kiosk app and some other scenarios where I try to make sure you work with AI until you meet the threshold score. It will continue to work on self-improving and get to that stage. So it's more about like feeding enough questions to AI, where instead of giving you like a one right answer right away, it keeps asking the question like, hey, have you covered this scenario? Have you covered that?
Yeah.
So it keeps asking into the loop until you meet the sort of a score threshold from that.
Yeah, it's like having this very experienced engineer peppering it with questions about like all the different scenarios that could go wrong. I mean, not all, but a large number of them, for it to like try to meet these hurdles. And this is before you're moving on. Like if we were looking at the pipeline, this is like pretty early before it's, you know, it's making the test cases. I don't know if calling it test driven is the term that we should use here, but it's not unlike that in some ways, but you're doing it to sort of seed the specifications way before, like, just write all this, you know, this new feature, this application.
Yeah.
Am I describing that correctly?
Exactly. So let's say if you start in a company or in a startup from a Figma, right? So you are writing requirements from the Figma.
Okay.
So if AI won't assume all these sort of different use cases, if you just initially provide the Figma and have it write PRD, so having that specific enrichment step, even in the first stage, you'll make sure you have the requirements, all those scenarios that I mentioned about those edge cases, you cover that as a part of requirement in the first steps.
Yeah.
And that kind of is automatically then it cascades to then a developer writing a code and then QA writing test cases or automation. It kind of starts from the initial sort of a pipeline of writing requirements from Figma. And then cascading effect is, as you have these sort of enrichment steps on every single pipeline of a phase, it helps to make sure it's improving at every step of the pipeline. So starting from Figma to requirements, you're already covering the basic edge cases in the initial steps.
Yeah.
So that once it's reached to a developer, they're already kind of covering all those edge cases in their writing code. And that's how in every step it improves. So yeah, that's why I kind of tried that on a couple of open source like projects I have. Now I really want to build on that and continue to try on other applications and see how it's like improving or how much change is it helping on real sort of real applications, real features. I'm hoping I work closely with other folks and they contribute and we try it on other applications and see how much difference, like what's the quality difference from like 60% to 80%, how much does it improving this step of enrichment.
That's interesting because I felt like you were specifying, based on the documentation that we were kind of looking at, the enrichment step being primarily, you know, after the initial design Figma kind of stuff and creating the specifications. But you're saying this enrichment can happen in the following stages of like, okay, we're now doing the coding or QA is coming out and looking at the test cases. This would be iterative in a way as we go along.
Definitely. Because what I've seen is like, in my experience, like AI gets you to 60-70%.
Okay.
In terms of the quality of stuff that you're looking for, and that it misses that 30% of edge cases, or it could be, and it goes in all the processes, right? Because how a product manager is thinking about requirements from a design is different from a QA engineer writing test cases from that. So each step has a unique sort of perspective where QA brings in, like in terms of even the requirements are there, right? There is still like different edge cases that QA engineer brings in terms of trying to cover different apps, different browsers, because all the customers are like global. They could be using like different versions of a yeah. iOS app, like working at Tinder, like
just insert the internet and it's going to get complex.
At Tinder, we were supporting like 8 or 9 iOS Android versions each for each application. And then obviously there is web platform, different browsers, Chrome, Safari, or what have you, right? So how you're making sure then as a QA, you are thinking about all these different sort of use cases. And all those users get a best experience depending on what version they are at, right? So each sort of a person brings the role, brings this, because product manager might not be thinking about that. Product manager is just focusing on iOS versus Android when they're thinking about requirements.
Yeah.
But then QA engineer comes up with all these different scenarios, edge cases. So each step kind of iteratively improves this process of specific enrichment and tries to get a better out of AI in terms of the quality of test cases it's writing or requirements it's gathering or code it's writing.
Yeah. It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. And it touches on some of the concepts that we cover this week. The course is titled Testing MCP Servers with a Python MCP Client. It's based on a RealPython tutorial by Leodanas Pozo Ramos. And for the video course, your instructor is previous guest Rodrigo Hira Serrao. And he takes you through building an MCP client app for the command line using the MCP Python SDK, connecting a client to an MCP server through the STDIO transport, and pointing it at a server from the command line, listing a server's capabilities, but calling the methods of list tools, list prompts, and list resources. Through the course, you'll practice setup, client structure, server connections, and capability discovery to test other MCP servers from your terminal. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. Our newest courses also have exercises for you to practice your knowledge as you work through the course. All our lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. So there's been this trend, as I've talked to people about various spec-driven development types of systems and even going into skills and some other things that are kind of popular terms now, this idea that as you refine these things, that often that information then gets saved in the repository along with that, like as markdown files or what have you. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the system that you're looking at here, that you're leaving these artifacts that are, if we had to start over or we had to, you know, look at a different approach, we could have this ground truth of these documents?
Yeah, definitely. So what the next step would be, once we kind of test it out on multiple applications, multiple versions, we add that as a skill where we can easily share, and just a markdown file, like I said, where you can just share that to anyone, any user, and they can just, what they will still need to do is provide enough context about the application, right? So they, what this sort of a skill generates is, and it's similar to like a automation engineer or a product manager agent, where you give like a basic sort of a, what you, in your startup, let's say if you're launching, you're working on a iOS app or web application, right? About some new social media feature or what have you, right? So you will still be providing all the context about what sort of your goals are for that social media application, right? What you're working on.
Sure.
But that agent or MD file or skill file would be more for a generic way of rules that we want the AI to follow. In this case, it would be just a specific enrichment rules that we have built in as a steps. And then you share that skill, and then what you use that skill, and you can incorporate that specific to whatever feature you're working on. So you will provide that context in that sort of IMD file, and then you start running it on every sort of a pipeline process in your step. So obviously, like any, unless you are working with your teammates who are working on the same repository, same product, then it's just reusable right away.
Yeah, yeah. Part of your process that you're creating throughout this is this idea of judging the work. I don't usually hear that come in, but maybe that is something that is, you know, coming from a testing framework. You have to judge like how the quality of your tests. Like there are a lot of examples that are out there now of like it creating tests that are just kind of ridiculous. Like they don't test functionality. They just test, you know, true or false, something very, very simple. And so I thought that was interesting that, you know, you talk a little bit about the LLM being a judge, but, you know, where does this fit into the whole thing? Like, you know, what is being judged and, you know, what are kind of the standards of judgment that we're looking at during the process?
Yeah. I mean, this is a fascinating idea where, like, let's say if someone, your leadership comes in like, hey, we want to move fast. Let's automate everything, right? Let's automate all the iOS or Android versions.
Yeah.
Let's say we're launching Tinder app, like we are releasing weekly, right? Let's just automate everything, every single version. And let's just make sure then we have those gates check in before we go to production, have those AI run the test and make sure everything is good, right? But then my kind of question was, how do we make sure what AI did was correct or is not just making some false positives? Because what my experience has been for the last 2 years is, and kind of a real example I give to my friends as well, I set a goal for my AI to, hey, let's get me to 100% pass rate before I deliver this product to real users. And what AI ended up doing was, I left in the night, like gave it that goal, get me to 100% pass rate for a test. And when I checked it,
see you tomorrow.
And I came back in the morning, and what AI did was it commented out like 7 out of 20 tests.
Oh.
And then said, hey, I commented out those, and then you are at 100% rate. So I did my job. Right. So that's kind of a joke I have. Okay. Like how do I make sure, how do I trust AI? Like, how do I judge that the work AI is doing is not hallucinating or just trying to satisfy my goal, but actually doing the work that I.
Yeah. It's, or just like, I judge this as not important.
Exactly. So AI kind of makes this.
Because I can't figure out how to pass it right now. And we need a result in the morning. Here we go.
Exactly. So I just commented out, hey, everything is good. You're good to go. So, right. So then, so that's a kind of interesting case where it still happens. Like it's still not perfect. But that's where I built in. And one example I can give, like say you have a QA team, they have backlog of like a visual regression test where basically you compare what's in production versus in the new feature, new UI that you're trying to launch.
Okay.
And what you try to do is have AI compare the snapshot of your app in production versus pre-prod, and you make sure you compare it. There is no contradiction, and it gives you like a pass or fail, or it will give you like, hey, maybe it's not sure, but it will give like a human to look at that and compare. So what if you just, especially if you're, like I said, you're launching an app to millions of users, right? If AI gives the wrong verdict, or if it's not correct, or it just tries to get you to 100% pass rate, right? Then you get into this, you're launching a feature which is like failing for real users in a real live environment.
Yeah, yeah. So is that where like Playwright and PyTest and things like that kind of fit into your pipeline?
They do, but yeah, that's where I think I want to put like LLM in front of the queue to even triage, like basically as a judge to look at what AI produced. So what I did was like you put LLM in the front, like, hey, you will do the judge work for me. And in terms of reviewing the artifact that my AI has produced. And then I will, as a human, I will only see the cases which the judge is unsure about, wrong about. And so it is doing the majority of the work.
Flagging of things.
And it comes back to me like, hey, these are the 5 use cases I'm not sure. Can you take a look at it? And that's where human in the loop comes in. And I can deep dive more in terms of the Cohen's Kappa, where I kind of use that as a way to, happy to provide more details as well as we talked through that, how I came up with that.
Yeah, so the common thing is to have multiple agents. And so I feel like this LLM that's acting as the judge is a separate agent. I don't know if it matters as if it's a different model per se, but it would have its own context that's based around doing this form of testing. I mean, are there advantages to using different models for that or different? I'm guessing you're going to provide it with a unique set of parameters, like you said, like it needs to meet these specifications for you to bubble this and up to me or flag this for me.
Yeah, I mean, as I was doing online research, like I really came down into this measurement called Cohen's Kappa,
okay,
where that basically measures agreement between two raters, like who are trying to judge the same thing. So what I noticed was, so let's say, like basically how to identify LLM is not like hallucinating, because if you just judge from a random sample, humans and LLMs can still agree on like 5 out of 7 out of 10 items, but then you don't really have a clear measure if LLM really has provided you right sort of accurate result, right? So what it does, it just measures that. You still have to train it initially. So let's say if you have a QA team or a real user developer product using a feature, right? What you will do is you will feed the AI system.
Okay.
So let's say you pick up 100 test cases for your, let's pick up any app or for users, Tinder or Amazon app, right? You give a couple of users, product manager or a QA engineer, go through this 100 sort of a test cases.
Right.
Where they will judge that, like, hey, is there any visual difference or not? So they will provide it a pass or fail criteria through the test case, right? And then once you get that enough data, you feed that into AI, then we compare that against with real LLMs, like it could be Claude or open source, Kimike or Codex, right?
Okay.
And then you compare that result versus AI, how is it doing? And basically that Cohen's Kappa result came in, like say there are 100 test cases, right? 90 are passing, but 10 are failing. And how do we make sure that LLM to identify those 10% sort of failures, right? That's where that measurement is like 0.7 out of 1 is where if you get to that number, only then you know that you have enough confidence. If you are above that 0.7 out of 1, the measurement that it comes up in the end, that's where I think that it then provides recommendation to you like, hey, it's good. The AI has done the job. Or if it's below the number, that's where humans in the loop come in. We start reviewing that. So I kind of incorporated that logic with the help of Python into my open source AIs. So what I did was I feed in like 100 or 200 images. Initially used like myself and my friend who looked at the images, provided pass and fail to that. And we did the same results with 3 other AI that I have put into my open source code.
Okay.
And have them sort of use that measurement as a way to then come up with a pass-fail rate. And that's where I found the successful results, where that really the measurement that Cohen's Kappa gives me like more confidence to be more trusting on AI rather than depending on just random LLM to say if I'm good or not.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's an interesting process. It definitely is something I think somebody would have to dig in a little bit deeper into. And you've mentioned it a couple times here that this is a project. and you're publishing a paper about the whole thing. Maybe we talk a little bit about that. Like, what is the project? Like, if somebody wanted to check it out and potentially use it, you know, I don't want to save this to the end. I want to kind of maybe mention a little bit earlier so that we can kind of refer to it a little bit more. But like, sort of describe what the project is. Like, we've been touching on it off and on, but maybe we can kind of clarify and then how people could potentially use it themselves.
Yeah. To summarize it, right? You have a team of folks working on it. So three questions I ask is like, hey, can you trust the LLM to like shrink that human in the loop work for you? That's the first question anyone asks when they're working on a project or a feature. Or if like LLM drifts, like let's say you get a new version of a Claude code or LLM, right? Or a prompt change, like how do you know before it ends up costing you a hotfix or an issue where let's say you have a payment app, have a user's failing on that, right? So what happens if LLM drifts or there is some data issue? Or let's say lastly, like what if your leadership asks you like, hey, how do you know AI is right? What do you show them? Like, how do you make sure that AI is doing its job right? So that Cohen's K is like answer to all three. Like it's the gauge like that sits top of the LLM, like as a judge in production. So without it, you just don't know. You have a black box. Like AI is just saying to you, it's doing a good job or not. But with it, you have a measurable, like clear alerting, auditable system you can build with the help of all the calculations it does in the back end and provides you in the end results of yes, LLM is good or not. So you just provide an extra layer of a judge where it really helps you to be more comfortable, more confident when you're still not perfect, but you still end up spending some time as a human. But then it gives you more confidence before you are launching a feature for a real users in production. That is the answer to all those three questions that I set up initially.
Yeah, yeah. So if somebody wanted to use this themselves, how would they get started with the project?
Yeah. So I'll share the link with you. It's on my GitHub. Hopefully you can share that in the comment section or in the notes.
Oh, yeah.
Where anyone can download it. So it's open source. And I already feed in around like, it's been working on this project for like a few months. So I feed in a lot of data where I tried it on different open source applications. Now it's for anyone to just download it and they can try that on a different sort of application they are building. So happy to like kind of work with anyone and kind of continue to improve that as a community as we try to figure out what other improvements we can do on it as well.
Yeah, yeah. And by people using it more, do you feel like that's going to maybe help with some of the stuff you're looking at of like, you know, maybe having a bigger sample size or other things for some of the judging? Is that something you're looking forward to?
Definitely. So like I have explored it on multiple applications, but I think with more people looking at it, there's an opportunity where we can further improve that and really start like it can be used with obviously more data set as system learns, right? With more data set, with more samples, you can further iteratively improve that system as a whole. So definitely, I think there is still, it's initial stages, but there is a lot of I can do or other folk can do in the community.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping with the white paper or with more sort of knowledge around it, definitely get people excited about it. And that's something I think it's, if you're working on any applications for your personal startup or anything, anywhere, that's just something critical piece, which I think the question gets asked about everyone, like how do we make sure we are shipping a good feature? And in the age of AI and hallucination,
yeah,
I think quality is something that we need to still ensure that it gets the focus on that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I feel like people are almost giddy to share problems, you know, that have people come across. And I don't know, as a person who's just playing with it on my own and not working for a larger company, like what are the problems people are having and, you know, how much of that stuff's under the wraps of the corporation? Like what are some of the failures that you've seen that you feel like this might help ameliorate or, you know, kind of calm in some ways? Like you mentioned a couple different areas, you know, one obviously is this under specification, hence why you have that enrichment stuff. But like, what's an example of where that can help?
Yeah, I mean, enrichment comes into like the example I gave, right? For you are trying to move fast, you're launching new features, but if you miss that enrichment step, then you're literally just then figuring out by getting the real feedback from customers on in production,
yeah,
and then trying to then iterate and getting hot fixes and get everyone just to fix that in time, right? So it works, but if there is a real user, real payments going on, there's a real impact where you have billions of users on Amazon or Ring or Tinder who are using your app day to day, you're moving fast. All these steps, and AI is not going anywhere, right? It's the term would be like, it's the worst AI is today ever been, right? So it's continuously improving. How do we make sure we can depend on AI and be still able to be flexible and launch these features to real users every day or every week? And that's where all these Cohen's Kappa and enrichment comes in, where it's just, it's a more, I would say, your tools to be more confident to say, yes, we're ready for our users every day to ship new features, to give them more sort of a new feature. Because I've seen in the 20 years, if there's an issue, you are literally working with different teams on call, getting the hot fixes live. I've seen that like nightly and weekends that I've done to get all the changes fixed to the users. So that helps save that sort of a complexity in the org. I mean, yeah, still it gets you like a more sort of help in terms of getting there and be more confident for shipping. Yeah, and I would say in future when agents are the customer, so agents are doing the majority of the work for users, then you will get the feedback right away. You will have multiple agents looking at your website or making changes, whatever the data they need, you will get the feedback right away. So you'll have to be more confident to ship the features, even for agents, to not just real live users as well.
Yeah. I kind of wanted to like just get another real world example, like, you know, what's a single failure mode that took the longest to find? Like what did that sort of teach you as you went through trying to find these edge cases and areas where things fall down?
Yeah, I mean, each company I would feel like had a different sort of issues I went through, where an example give at Ring, where Halloween was the biggest sort of a event we had yearly, where every year on a Halloween night, you had folks ringing the doorbell pretty much the time period from 2 p.m. to whatever, 7, 8 p.m., right? So you literally have...
Depending on the neighborhood, yes.
Exactly. So that's where, as a user, you might not feel, but at Ring, we would prepare like 1 year in advance where we start working on that just for one day, that big day where we are kind of preparing our servers, getting enough load ready. So we are preparing that just for one single night of users using that doorbell, right? So an issue we would face is like, even if with all the preparation we would do for 8-9 months, we would still find some other edge cases which we might not be able to catch, where either the doorbell is not functioning or there's some other issue. So even with that preparation, you still miss the real use case, edge case, which our users provide to us. So then you continuously learn every year. So I would say like last 2-3 years when I was there, we were able to get there like from our learnings from the previous years. We were able to accommodate all those edge cases. So that was the one example. I would say like no matter how much you prepare, you still are still catching up what users can do in a real life situations. So you are constantly learning in terms of, again, like feedback loop you get from your previous issues. So you do the root cause analysis, you learn from it and make sure you set the mechanisms so that it doesn't occur in future. So you set up the right processes, right mechanisms, where you are not a blocker as an engineer, as a QA, but you set up the right mechanisms where as a learnings, anyone who comes in after you or some different team member, they are able to leverage that mechanism so that it doesn't occur in future.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about.
So it's that some mechanism of future, like processes I set up in my teams where, but yeah, I mean, fires could occur through different ways of issues or website being down or app not working or crashing on a lower end devices. So every day is exciting. You're just constantly figuring out like a new issue. So each domain had this sort of odd uniqueness in terms of issues that you see day to day.
Yeah. It's funny because I would imagine you sit down a new engineer and ask them the question like, okay, so like, what's the worst day of the year potentially for us? Exactly. And ask them that question and then like run through the scenarios. You're sort of like, wargaming or doing some other types of tests based upon the results of the previous year.
Yeah, so use like synthetic data or chaos engineering. That's a term again is there as well. So you try to use that, all the real life synthetic data, and try to recreate those scenarios.
Yeah.
Use different ways of this server testing. I mean, that's a whole different topic of like how that server testing, what different testing you do in which process, from integration to regression. But yeah, it's a whole different ballgame. But yeah, so.
Yeah, I'd heard that system at Netflix, the Chaos Monkey or whatever, which was like just unplugging and attaching types of things. Did you see things like that at the other organizations you worked at?
Yeah. So we try to inbuilt, not that I would say compared to Netflix, but yeah, we try to build that into our processes, especially with low load testing and stress testing.
Yeah.
We try to incorporate some of those in my experience at different companies I had.
So if somebody wanted to check this out, we've mentioned that they can go to the repository, which we'll have links for and so forth. But like, if you had a suggestion for a way for somebody to get started and trying this out, like, you know, what's a inexpensive way for them to get in?
Yeah, definitely. What I would suggest to them is just try on a smaller scale. So you're not looking for, let's say, just trying to build an application from scratch. So what I would try to do is like, just put up like a smallest step would be put up two scripts, whatever files that you might have, and then just try to compare them. So just don't go in detail like testing like a full sort of application. Start with a small sort of a use case you might have that you want to validate.
Yeah.
Start with a basic thing, see if it works or not. And then once you feel like it's helping you in terms of bringing value to your sort of use case, then you can use that and ask AI to like how you can further integrate that into your sort of a daily release process or whatever you're trying to do in your startup or or company or application as well.
Well, it sounds like that's what you've done yourself. Like you mentioned, you know, revising your website and doing things like that. Has that been the case that you like kind of try little small projects to experiment on these things?
Exactly. So it lives in all my sort of projects that I'm sort of building. And what I've noticed is, iteratively, I continue to like improve, less and less dependent on me as a human to kind of to be that sort of person in the loop. So that's where I think it helps me to further like move faster, because I'm the slowest person in my team apart from my agents. So I'm the one who is blocking all the slowing down my projects versus my other agent that I have built, from an engineering manager agent to a developer agent. So I'm the slowest person in the team. So I'm just, with the help of the processes, I'm trying to improve, be less and less involved as a human. And I have really seen incremental improvements in terms of the velocity that I'm able to release something to production.
I feel like that's a balance, though. Like, we've stressed multiple times the human in the loop as part of this and it potentially slowing things down. But that knowledge is still going to be pretty critical, you know, at least as we continue to refine the tools.
Definitely. I think having that, especially for me, like having the experience of working on real life applications for 20 years,
right,
that really helps to be able to like work. Basically, it provides me agency to like use agents in a way where they will help me to make my day, like improve my velocity, move it faster. But I think still, if you are someone new, just don't get discouraged by it. You are AI native, so you are able to just quickly learn with AI, and you are able to also move faster. So I wouldn't discourage anyone who is starting in this field. There is definitely an opportunity to work with the agents and kind of continue to have that feedback loop and improve as well.
Yeah. Did we hit most of the stuff that you wanted to touch on?
I continue to publish more about as I kind of learn more ways. So I have also a couple of more papers not related to these that I'm trying to publish as well.
Okay.
Those go into more in terms of how the process looks like, in terms of different agents you can use to build this SDLC lifecycle. So I've been trying to kind of publish more and more papers as I find more topics to research on. So it's something that I'm able to leverage AI and really be more productive on my days too. Really good talk with you, really.
Yeah.
Appreciate the time.
I have these questions I like to ask everybody who comes on the show. And the first one is, what's something that you're excited about that's happening in the world of Python?
First of all, like, honest answer, like Python was not even my first language. Like in my career, like I used Java, Ruby, TypeScript.
Yeah.
But I ended up in the last like year, especially on working on this Cohen's Kappa and all those measurements, where Python was the language that had been used in the past as well, with from other users. So I was able to leverage that, the ecosystem that Python had in terms of seeding first, like discipline, where I was able to leverage that and really take the help of AI and be able to further improve and improve my process of moving faster. But really excited, like really, I feel like it's I'm learning every day.
Yeah.
So I would say, yeah, give me more opportunities to be able to ship these products much faster. Where in the pre-IA days, I would be spending like a few weeks just to learn the language from scratch. But now I'm able to talk to it and just use Python to be able to ship features very fast.
That's good.
So that's, I think, yeah, especially the Python, like, evaluation layer is really helping in the AI lingo as well, in terms of using that to evaluate and have the whole ecosystem built around it.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff that you have as examples are TypeScript, I noticed, which I'm always confused at the age of it, because, you know, being a Python person, I don't know all the background on it. But is that recent for you too? Like when did you get involved with TypeScript?
Yeah, with all the Playwright and all the Cypress, the tools started, I believe, in last 2-3 years.
Okay.
With the TypeScript, because usually Java would be the main language, Java or JavaScript.
Yeah.
In the last 2-3 years, with the new tools like Playwright, Cypress, and how the whole automation landscape is changing from Selenium to these new tools, I think in future you will be like language agnostic. You just talk to AI and it will
right.
just do it for you. So you just talk in binary zeros and ones directly.
Right. So or it can just translate the language, the majority of it for you.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
So what's something that you want to learn next? It doesn't have to be about programming. It could be cooking or welding or something else like that. What are you interested in learning next?
Just trying to find like new topics, anything that I can still leverage AI. I'm trying to learn golf on the side. That's something.
Sure.
Again, I don't know how much AI can help me with that, but that's definitely on my thing. Like I did take some lessons, but I feel like if you start very late, it just takes that lot more time than if I would have started, like, let's say I was in my teens or early years.
It's hard to get your muscles to get comfortable, you know, learning, you know, those positions. It feels like we're way more, I don't know, plastic, you know,
exactly.
When you're younger, as far as being able to adjusting. Yeah.
Yeah. So with my son growing up, I feel like I can use this time to kind of either vicariously or have him learn these and use this opportunity to learn along with him some of these activities.
Yeah.
So
cool.
I'm excited for that.
Well, what's the best way that people can follow your work online?
Yeah, they can find me on LinkedIn. I'll share the link with you. There's a website, sunitmalhotra.com. They can use that or my GitHub. I'll share that with you. Hopefully you can leave that in your notes.
Yeah.
And they can reach out to me via LinkedIn as well.
Well, Sunit, thanks for reaching out to me. It's been fun to talk to you.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, I appreciate it. Nice talking to you.
I want to thank Sunit for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.